If you're hearing this, it means tickets are now on sale for our streaming Cybactacular.
That's what we're calling the streaming show of our Star Trek V review that we toured last year. We filmed our Hollywood show, and it's going to be streaming on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the stream will be available for a couple of weeks after that. If you can't watch right at the premiere time. A couple of pieces of information about this. If you support us at MaximumFun.org/join and your membership is current, check your email inbox because Maximum Fun will have emailed you a promo code to get $5 off your ticket. And also, we have some VIP packages available that include a meet and greet with me and Adam. Those are going fast, so jump on that if you want a meet and greet VIP package. Again, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets for the streaming Cybactacular.
My friends, the great experiment.
Discovery. Hidden. Trick.
Would you look at that?
The greatest trick.
And you people, you're all astronauts on some kind of Star Trek.
Welcome to Greatest Trek. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Anna Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison.
My studio is wafting with a scent that all dog owners know. I think you know what I'm talking about. The smell of a stink stick being consumed. Beloved Ripley is at my feet just going to town on this thing, and it smells pretty bad.
I don't know if I'm like particularly insensitive to this one particular smell, because I am generally speaking quite sensitive to smell. Like, I used to have a roommate who was very fond of Axe body spray, and I would like start sneezing in my room when he started using it before I was even conscious of smelling it, and there'd be two closed doors in between us.
Amazing.
And yet, the bull crank that dogs so thoroughly enjoy chewing on has never been the most offensive smell to me.
Look, I'm glad we're using the whole buffalo here. Got to do something with those cranks. Might as well give our sweet pups something to enjoy. But Lordy, even the ones stamped will not stink up your room. They're always stinky, right?
Hey, Adam, speaking of leathery old cranks, I have a story to tell you.
Just absolute championship pivot right there. Like, that was the mid-range jumper to win the NBA finals right there by you. Please go on.
I got a nice, we both got this nice invite from a friend of the show and showrunner of Star Trek Prodigy, Aaron Waltke, to go to Bill Shatner's 93rd birthday party.
Look, my policy is if invited, go to every wedding, every funeral, and every older person's birthday party. Those are the rules, right?
Yeah. We don't know how long we're going to have this national treasure around.
Hey, let's make a bet. Are you making it over or under 93 years old? Let's put it down on tape right now. Let's make the bet.
I thought we were betting on Shatner as you started into this.
Oh, like a Shatner alive at the time of this recording?
Yeah, right.
No, I don't play the death pool.
I think I could make it to 93. My grandfather made it to 96, and his sister made it to 103. So,
wow, you got those good genes.
Yeah, on my dad's side of my family, I've got some very long-lived individuals.
I have long-lived individuals in my family, too, but they're miserable. Are the older folks in your family, like, happily in their 90s, or are they hating it?
I would say that my grandfather and my great-aunt were both eccentric characters who were enjoying their 90s in their way, you know?
Okay.
Not necessarily in a way that would like appear outwardly like it was a source of great enjoyment, but I think they had a hoot living that long.
I think our lives resemble that somewhat, don't you think?
Yeah, fingers crossed. But yeah, this was connected to a screening of this new documentary called You Can Call Me Bill, which was sort of a memoir, sort of a, I'm not really sure what this documentary was. I mean, it like, it did have some like upshot in the end. Like it felt like it did build to something.
Uh-huh.
But it is like literally just, they sat down and interviewed Shatner in a kind of freewheeling conversation that did not necessarily start or end anywhere. Like to some extent it like followed the course of his life and like was some remembrances about his life, but it wasn't like an autobiography or a biography of Shatner or anything like that.
Right. And he was heavily involved in it, right? So it's going to get the Shatner spin.
Yeah.
This isn't like a hard hitting all of the warts and all.
No, yeah. Sort of no gotcha questions appear to have been posed to Shatner in the filming of this production.
Right. But I mean, he's a man who's had a life that has been filled with conflict and sadness. Like,
yeah.
Did the movie include it? Those things?
It really didn't touch too much on like famous feuds that he's had or anything like that. Like, I would say that like a lot of it felt like it was leading up to him having a very profound experience when he went to space for 3 minutes on Jeff Bezos's penis rocket.
Yeah. Yeah. And from what I read in the press, like he was moved in kind of a terrible way by it.
Yeah. Like it kind of like shook him to his core and made him reevaluate a lot of things. Like not necessarily the things that I would have personally hoped he might reevaluate, but
like who your friends are and why for some reason Jeff Bezos is one of them.
Yeah. I mean, like it's definitely not a persuasive sales pitch for go to space. Like one of the big sponsors of the event was like an organization that like, I guess what they do is like you write an essay and they like determine if you're worth a free trip to space, and then you get to go in the penis rocket.
So someone at Amazon was the whale reading all of these essays.
Yeah. And I was like, man, like nothing has ever made me want to go to space less than this documentary.
Did you get to hear snippets from these essays?
No, that didn't really factor into it.
Were they essays that were like college entrance exam style essays? Like, here's why I deserve to go?
I don't know, Adam. They just described that this was an organization that was sponsoring. That wasn't the subject of the event. I wish I could answer your questions. I too am curious.
This is, we're probably better off that I didn't go to this event.
So I went with Aaron and other friend of the show, Jordan Morris, co-host of Jordan, Jesse, Go, right here on the Maximum Fun Network. We, you know, met up for a drink before, and then we watched the movie and all like pretty much enjoyed the movie, but like we're also like, what was that exactly? And then at the end, we were right by the Culver Studios, which is now, I guess, production space that is owned by Amazon. But the soundstage that they shot the pilot of Star Trek, the original series at, was the location of, for some reason, hosted by Kevin Smith, the 93rd birthday party of Bill Shatner.
Kevin Smith, the Mallrats Kevin Smith?
The Mallrats Kevin Smith. And
wow.
Also, this was catered by Dave and Buster's.
Now, for a lot of people, the food at Dave and Buster's might not be the first thing you think of when you think of Dave and Buster's. Did you have to like bowl a skee ball into a hole in order to get tickets to exchange for that food?
I did not. My plate was largely chicken wing based, which was amazing because I'd had chicken wings at lunch that day. And then when we met up for drinks before the show, we, you know, ordered some snacks for the table while we were shooting the breeze. And one of the things that got ordered was chicken wings. So it was a day where I had 3 different servings of chicken wings.
I love that day. I love that day for you. I love it for me.
Yeah, it was great. It was like David Buster's capably catered this festivities.
Ben, people in the bonus feed know that you are a professional food critic and reviewer. How would you rank the wings that you had that day?
Let's see. So I had barbecue wings, regular buffalo style wings, and honey sriracha wings. And I would say that my power ranking was honey sriracha at the top.
Yeah. Get that sweet heat.
Barbecue, then buffalo.
Then buffalo. Yeah. Interesting.
But they were good. I mean, it, it was a surprising event for me because we have gone to several like LA area Star Trek events together over the years. And a couple of times you've gone and I couldn't, or vice versa. But I think that the crowd at those has started to be filled with familiar faces, like people that I know enough to say hi to, but also people I just recognize from having seen at other Star Trek things. And this Bill Shatner birthday party slash documentary event was full of like Hollywood hunks and babes. Like there was a step and repeat that was full of like super duper attractive people that seemed like they might be professionally attractive.
God, I wish I was that.
Yeah, no, I mean, so aspirational. Bill Nye was there. I got to see Bill Shatner meet Bill Nye for the first time.
Not Bill Nighy. Bill Nye, the science guy.
Yeah.
Not the actor guy.
Not the science guy. But like, you know, no Larry Nemechek, no Mission Log guys.
I'm shocked by that. What?
Yeah, I was really surprised that I didn't. The one person that was like actively Star Trek affiliated that was pointed out to me, aside from Aaron Waltke, was the guy that is playing Locke in Star Trek Discovery, who I just had to take everyone's word for it that he was playing Locke because I have only seen him in Loaf otherwise.
Sure. This is an idiotic question. I can't believe I waited this long to ask it. Was Bill Shatner there?
Yeah, he was there.
All right.
He had Kevin Smith seemed to be very friendly.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they weren't like mingling with the hoi polloi down on the floor, but they got up on the stage and like everybody sang Bill Shatner the birthday song and everything, which was pretty amazing.
Wow.
And there was like a band and they were all dressed in like their Starfleet uniforms, except for they weren't playing parodies of songs. They were just playing like Play That Funky Music, White Boy.
Love a live band. That's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they seemed like a capable like wedding band that was, for some reason, Star Trek themed.
Did I tell you about the wedding band I saw up in Seattle called No Rules? And it was just a group of a dozen between 50 and 60-year-old dudes wearing like embellished suit jackets with like bedazzled parrots on the back and like epaulets and stuff. God, that was the best wedding band I ever saw. I think about them a lot.
Were they like nudie suits, like Western style, or were they?
Pretty sure this was a jacket only situation. Like you could wear whatever you want on bottom, but but the jackets made you part of the band. Like you're in a gang, dad gang.
So it was more of a like no rules below the waist type situation.
Yeah, sure is.
It was a lot of fun. Can't say I give a full-throated rec to the documentary, but it was there were some interesting parts for sure. And if you're like really curious about that trip to space on the penis rocket, it talks a lot about that in an interesting way that gives me some perspective that I hadn't really heard about what it's like to go to space.
Sounds like this movie might not work in a bonus feed episode.
Yeah. I don't know if I really want to watch it again.
Fair enough. Well, one thing we both wanted to watch was the third episode of this season of Star Trek Discovery. Ben, you want to get into that?
Yeah, we've really tarried too long, haven't we?
Today's ep is Star Trek Discovery, Season 5, Episode 3. It's called Janal.
You know the greatest danger facing us is an irrational fear of the unknown.
And in our cold open, Disco is parked outside of Federation HQ. They're preparing to go to Trill, and Burnham and Book and Culber are walking around inside talking about Mull and Locke. And I didn't like how this conversation went because it's been established for a couple episodes that should Mull and Locke find this secret thing everyone's looking for, It would be very bad, and many, many people would die. But the point of this conversation is that Mull has had a tough upbringing and may be worthy of some sympathy here. Even though she seeks to destroy everything and everyone in the universe. So that could be a problem. And also Book's relationship with her could be a problem.
Yeah. And Book's eccentric approach to judgment surrounding situations that affect him personally.
I'm learning from my choices.
I love that word when we talk about Book. Kind of an eccentric individual.
Yeah. He really wants to go to Trill with them. Burnham is not so sure. So she says, like, I'm a think about it. But they're, like, headed right there. Like, they're leaving soon. So she doesn't have long to think about it.
Burnham would have to kick him off the ship, I guess, if he wasn't allowed. Or just, like, on the surface is the thing in question.
That's a great point. Like, he can go to Trill without going to Trill.
We cut over to Book's apartment where his furniture is getting absolutely shredded by his cat. A cat we haven't seen for 2 episodes now.
Yeah.
Just being left alone. The way cats like it.
Yeah. Culber does sort of a drive-by therapy on Michael Burnham. He remembers that she has done Vulcan meditation to clear her mind in the past. And has she been trying that in the present? She's like, God, it's been like 1,000 years since I've done that. Literally. And they all like laugh and slap each other on the back.
Hey, you know what doesn't work in real life is when you notice a friend or a companion might be struggling and you suggest that they do the thing that makes them feel better. That doesn't work in my experience. What? You're saying I need to do Vulcan meditation? I'm fine.
You need to do fucking Vulcan meditation.
Why don't you work on your own shit?
Yeah. It's the kind of thing that works in Discovery uniquely. Like,
yep.
It is so effective in Discovery in a way that it never is in any other context.
Yeah.
In engineering, they're talking about how big Trill is. Like, it's lots of square miles that they would potentially need to survey to figure out where the clue is going to be.
Did we know this before, that Trill was an absolute unit of a planet? I like knowing this.
Yeah.
Trill has a surface area of 500 million square kilometers.
I like knowing their relative sizes more.
I want to get into a planet measuring contest, yeah. You know?
I do too. You measure from the polar region. That's what you do.
So they're talking about how they don't really know, like, a where, but they might know a who, because the artifact that Burnham found had some dots on the side of it that are a perfect Trill fingerprint for somebody named Janelle Bix. And that is a person that lived 800 years ago, around the time that the Enterprise D encountered the progenitors. So, yeah, they're going to go down there looking for this person, or the symbiont of this person, see if that symbiont's still kicking.
People who don't know any better feel like tribal Trill band tattoos are all the same, but they're not. They're different, every one of them.
Different ones mean different things. And yeah, it seemed like that kind of convinced Michael Burnham to bring Book on the mission in a way that I didn't totally get. Like, mm-hmm. What about the reveal of the existence of this particular guy made her want to say that? But yeah, so Book's going.
Books is going to look for Bix.
Maybe that's what it is.
Do you think when there's a like family reunion of all of the Bookers, it's a group of Bix? To pluralize it? Mm-hmm. In Australia, it would be. They're Bix. G'day. Nair. I was looking at our metrics there, Ben, as I said that, and we've gone from 3 subscribers in Australia to 1.
Yeah, I just got an email from our friend and agent that we will never book a live show in the antipodes.
So that's the mission Find Janelle Bix.
Hey, but we need a B story, don't we?
Can we please have a B story? I'd like that.
That would be great. So that is going to be about Captain Rayner, I guess now Commander Rayner, mm-hmm. who he really has a tough time this episode, and it really starts here. He attempts to break the ice with Captain Burnham.
I trust your quarters are satisfactory.
They're fine. A little smaller than I'm used to, but then again, I'm used to having your job.
It just doesn't work. His bit falls flat.
I mean, you're allowed to do bits on captains. It's just this is a bad bit moment.
It's a bad bit moment.
Burnham has assigned him a series of what modern people would know as like parent-teacher conferences. Like, mm-hmm. come and meet Commander Rayner and get to know him. And he is naturally like, you know, I'd rather just do the actual mission, the Maul mm-hmm. and Lock mission, the thing that I am uniquely obsessed with. And she's like, nah, one-on-ones first. That's the priority.
I don't blame him for this. Like, I mean, my mom was a teacher when I was growing up, and like the most stressful time of year for her, she was a resource specialist. So she worked with kids with mm-hmm. disabilities and learning delays and things like that. And the like part of her year where she had to have IEP conferences with the families of these students was like by far the most stressful time of year for her, just because it's like, I don't know, a bunch of unknowns come up.
Parents come at you from all angles.
Yeah. Some of them are like, you're not helping my kid enough. Others are like, fuck you for saying my kid needs extra help, you know, and everything in between.
That's fun. Your mom doesn't take any guff either in the moments that we've had interactions. Like I imagine she's sturdy for moments like that.
Yeah, she has pretty low guff tolerance, I would say. But yeah, so he's like, do I really have to do this? I have to have a bunch of IEP meetings with everyone on the crew.
What's funny about the order Michael Burnham gives him and the scene that follows immediately after is that this might as well be the introduction we get to all of the crew people. And it's all that we'll ever get. This could be the first and last time we meet these folks. Outside of like any reaction shots we may get during an action sequence.
Right. Some of these characters have names? News to us.
I was shocked by this. Yeah. Everyone gets a moment. And then we get a nice little drive away out of Space Dock and into Black Alert. And then we blurp at Trill.
The greatest trick.
Down in engineering, Adira is real jittery. And it's not just all the Rakdadino they've been pounding. It's also the fact that they're going to be seeing Gray for the first time in 6 months, I think, is what they say. And so Jet Reno is like trying to be the counselor here.
You look great, kid.
Was there anything you knew about Jet Reno that made it believable that she would just absorb this shit from Adira without becoming frustrated and walking away? Like, good for Jet. To just, like, be the audience.
Yeah. I was amazed that Stamets didn't care, because Stamets has traditionally cared way too much about what Adira's going through also.
Wow. How hands-off is Stamets here in this scene? Like, he's basically in soft focus the whole time.
Yeah, and he's like, good luck with that in the background.
This moment when Adira gets called to the bridge, I replayed 10 times. Because it sounded like whoever was calling them there said, effing tall, report to the bridge. Like, as if effing was a crew designation. Is Adira an ensign? I can't remember.
Yeah, I think that must be what they were actually saying.
Effing tall, captain's asking for you on the bridge.
It sounded so much like effing. I'm sure Adira gets that a lot when they stand next to Gray, though. Mm-hmm. God, you're effing tall.
Yeah, Tall was the name of the symbiont, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So is it also Gray Tall? That's weird. They're dating and they have the same last name?
Yikes. So when Adira leaves, Jet and Stamets are able to talk freely about the 6 months apart thing. And Stamets in this scene is like, yeah, I don't see what the problem is. And Jet is like, I've been in the real world. these sorts of long distance things don't often work. You gotta get ready for a rough ride.
Trouble in paradise, genius.
Stamets just cannot get on the same page.
I love the question, should I be worried?
Yeah.
The answer is always no. You know, like, worrying doesn't help anything.
It's interesting, like, do we know if Jet is a parent?
I don't know if that's ever been addressed.
So it's interesting that there's like a little bit of advice being given here, but also you could argue that Stamets is like a different kind of parent too, and very new. So like, yeah, maybe that's why the advice is welcome here.
He really fully exemplifies the moniker Space Dad, I would say.
That's a terrible stereotype, Ben. So, Ben, you might be wondering if the crew can just beam on down to Trill and begin the mission. Permission denied.
Ooh. Yeah, Guardian Z hollows up to the bridge and is like, you can go down, but only if you answer this riddle one. And Burnham is like, isn't it usually riddles three? And he's like, yeah, but just this time it's just this riddle one. And here's the riddle. And she's gets it really quickly. It's like, it's basically just like there was that poem in the last episode. And like, if you just read up to the fourth stanza, I mean, it was like answered in the last episode. They thought that it was four stanzas and then they found the fifth stanza.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you think the answer was before? We thought it was Beta Zed.
I was hoping so much for a reaction shot from all the bridge stations. She's doing it.
Like it's Riker reconnects the saucer in the pilot of TNG. Like, holy fucking shit. She has it. Wow.
Pop quiz, Ben. I didn't tell you I was going to do this.
Oh, fuck.
Are you ready?
Okay.
You must answer the question.
Now, everyone knows that Guardian Z might be the only Star Trek character named after a paper towel brand.
Hmm.
My question for you is, Ben, can you identify another Star Trek character that shares the name with a brand of paper towels?
Oh, man. I know that there was a starship called the Bounty.
Great vamp.
Is there a Viva? Is there a character named Viva? Something?
Oh, I'm sorry. I think you were looking for Cabrani. But the real answer, Ben, is Scott Paper Towels for Montgomery Scott.
Wow.
Answer, Scott.
I don't think of Scott Paper Towels as being paper towels so much as sheets of loose leaf paper that happen to be connected to each other in a roll.
Yeah. Yeah. That really puts you on the spot, Ben. I thought you were a great game show contestant, though, for that moment.
Oh, thanks.
Good job.
Yeah, I've been practicing. I went on Troubled Waters as part of the Max Fun Drive, so I've got a little bit of like game show experience recently. So anyways, yeah, they're like, okay, yeah, you can beam down, meet this lady that is now the person in whom Bix lives. Nobody else has come and asked to see her, which is great news. Means that they're way ahead of Maul and Locke. And so they get to beam right down to the Ankylosaur caves on Trill.
Have you ever been the last person to show up for goth spa day vacation? That's what it's got to feel like here.
Oh, yeah. It's very embarrassing for Culber to show up in white.
Yeah.
It's goth spa day, Culber.
They meet Kawasara Bix right away. And right away, she says that she can't help them. Only Janelle Bix can.
He requires that you speak with him directly.
Their confusion here made a lot of sense to me because I'm like, all right, well, like, squint your eyes and let me talk to Janelle Bix. But no, they want to do that thing where they transfer a Trill's personality into another person. Like, that's what they want to do here.
They want to do a facet, like they did with Dax.
I think if you volunteer for this, you should not be allowed to do it.
Right, yeah.
Culber is way too interested in this.
Captain, Janelle can use me.
And I love the way he describes himself here, because he's like, when you're as emotional as I am, how much more emotional can one person be? I'm already topped off, baby. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I spent years in the like mycelial network fighting for my life. I can take anything you can throw at me.
If we're standing at the emotional gas pump, the pump has already clicked, but you're riding it out trying to get an even number on the payment.
You're trying to get an even number while smoking. It's just, it's remarkable.
It's fun to do bad things.
I also just love that, like, a big part of the motivation for Bix and Bix's host is they're both just fucking tired and want to die. The symbiote has been waiting for hundreds of years for somebody to show up and answer this easy-ass riddle. Like, finally, like, can we just get on with this? Like, there's a moment where Michael Burnham pauses and she's like, come on, like, speed it up here. I don't have a lot of time.
Yeah. Yeah, there is that energy to this scene. She looks ashen and ashy. Like a stiff wind could blow her away.
I am too old for your bullshit.
Young minds, fresh ideas, be told.
Back at Federation HQ, Saru is setting up his new office with a whole bunch of those plants that he liked having in his quarters on the ship. And Trina shows up with a housewarming present of another potted plant, which he accepts gracefully but seems to hate. Did you pick up on this? Like,
this is like bringing a bottle of wine to some friends who are really into wine. Like, yeah. I don't know. I mean, I guess you could, but...
Yeah, we're just going to put this over here. Because he puts the plant, like, as far from the other plants as you possibly could put it.
Also, if your man's room has visible gas permeating the air... I don't know if that's a place I want to stay.
Yeah.
They're talking about the engagement announcement that they've been collaborating on. And there are some descriptive words being used for Saru that he was really surprised by. Handsome and erudite being those words he was shocked to read. And Tarina's like, yeah, that's you, buddy. And he's like, well, usually when people include me on invitations, lethal head spikes that shoot from my head and dog dick fingers are in those invitations. And I didn't see either of those descriptions in here. Am I just seeing an early draft?
Yeah. Like, I just want to make sure that we're like on the same page here, because these are kind of technically coming from you and me. So if I include the thing about handsome and erudite, it kind of seems like I'm talking myself up.
Right.
So I just want to make sure that I give the full spectrum of descriptors so it doesn't seem too egotistical.
If we're really sure we want to gas me up, we should probably include something like runs and fucks like a horse. Basically does so many things like a horse. You have no idea.
Her assistant Dugan shows up, and this guy seems to be an assistant in both personal and professional matters, because he's talking about the diplomatic conference that they're about to have and is also taking responsibility for sending out the save the dates.
Did you clock him right away as a uh-oh, like this guy's gonna be a problem? In a relationship sense, like...
Yeah, yeah. That pause when he's hearing about the save the date. I mean, I thought he was just going to tell Saru not to get the cheapest ones from the back of the book, because...
Yeah.
You could run into, you know, poisonous adhesive situation.
We're expecting about 200 people.
Then he'd be stuck running a foundation instead of whatever diplomatic work he's going to do.
Exactly. Back on Disco, Tilly shows up at the science lab that Rayner is working out of. She's going to be the oil to his water in this episode. And he is pissed off about the one-on-ones assignment that he got from Captain Burnham and doesn't want to do it. So he's going to do it while also working some science, you know, trying to figure out where Maul and Locke might be, because he feels like that's a better use of his time. So with that agreed to, I guess Tilly just kind of like becomes his scheduler. She like gets all the crew wrangled to come check in with him.
Didn't you want to see more of the interstitial scenes we didn't get of Tilly setting up the crew people for this moment? Like, I think there's comedy there to be had. This episode chooses comedy very specifically, but I think there's a lot more and different here than they actually use. And it would help you get to know Tilly and the crew people better, because as it is, like, the comedy you get is from the awkward interactions between Rayner, who is someone we kind of know, and every single crew person, which we don't know at all. And, like, give me Tilly and those crew people to just give me anything about these other folks.
I mean, it seems like, I don't know, like, Tilly has relationships with those other characters in a way that is, like, pretty unique on the show.
Yeah.
I don't know. Detmer and Owo being not in this episode sort of felt like they were, like, writing around them in a weird way.
Yeah.
And it sort of made me wonder if there was, like, a scheduling thing or something. Because, yeah, like, Tilly going to Owo going, like, oh, man, just, like, kill this guy with kindness. I really don't know what to say. Would have been a much more interesting scene than some of the ones that we got.
I've got some thoughts on Rayner that I think I'm going to save for the end, but this is the moment in the episode where I started to consider why a show that seems so insistent on accepting every type of person and every kind of personality is telling Rayner how to be, and how unfair that seemed.
Interesting.
So anyway, back on Trill, Adira and Gray finally have a hug that's had a 6-month break. And remember how Gray is a golem? You remember that, right?
Yeah.
Golem Gray has been away for a long time. And I think in that amount of time has become extremely poised and self-aware, probably because he's had some life experience off of USS Feelings. And I think this is the scene that really cements, like, there was a lot of doubt that Adira had before they went their separate ways about, like, the ship is where I need to be. It's the home I need to have. And I think there was some conversation about, like, the growth that Gray might have and maybe the lack of growth that Adira might experience. And that seems to have happened.
Yeah. Yeah. They sort of feel like they are heading in different directions. I mean, it felt in the earlier conversation between Jet Reno and Adira like what Adira was sort of dreading was it is sort of obvious we need to break up, and that is a conversation that is probably going to happen on this visit. And then in this scene, it felt very similar, like there's an elephant in the room that we need to discuss.
What do you think about we need to talk later as a thing? I don't think it needs to be said, ever. If you need to talk later, just talk later, because what you're doing is torturing another person.
It's violence. Yeah. Like, I think that there are people that are not anxious in that way and, like, can hear I need to talk to you later and be perfectly contented to wait until they find out what that person wants to say to them. I am not one of those people. That is just the most misery I can go through, is finding out I need to talk to someone later.
I think there is a spin you can put on it that takes the ball of fangs away, which is like, hey, let's hang out later. Like or something. Any version that is not literally we need to talk later probably plays a lot better. But this is another example of Gray being a person that can just, like, be direct and specific.
Yeah.
And cut to the chase.
In a way that Adira really struggles with.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they do the ritual, and Janal shows up in Culber. I thought this was really fun to see Wilson Cruz just put on a different mask and play a really different character.
I think Culber was ready for Janal Bix to be put inside him because he was wearing a Trill plug to this meeting. You can't just roll up to a situation like this cold.
No, you got to clean out. You know, there's prep.
You got to get your mind right.
Likes the uniform. he is going to take them for a long walk to find the clue. And I love that they're just like, it's clues. It's clues and it's a mystery and we're going to go find the clues. Like, there's no pretense that they're, you know, assembling a relic. It's just, we're answering riddles and doing clues right now in this adventure.
I'm with you. I love seeing the I'm a cowboy in a cowboy movie gear for him. Like, that's fun. Yeah. Like, the raspy low voice is interesting. The saunter is fun. Yeah. Like, his physicality is great.
I like that he likes the body.
Yeah.
There's like a Freaky Friday, like, all right, kind of element to this.
This guy really works out.
This is one of those moments, though, that kind of shook me because, like, why doesn't Janelle Bix ask why they want what they're looking for? Like, passing the two-factor authentication is one thing, but, like, this is the moment where an explanation is kind of required.
Yeah.
But no, they just start walking together.
Yeah, well, I think that kind of, that's sort of answered over the course of this storyline.
It is, that's the point.
In an interesting way, but, like, it definitely feels like a strange tension that's not a question being asked here.
Yeah.
We need to score a lot of laps fast.
Licensed businessman.
Hi, this is Biz, and this is the final season of One Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting. This is going to be a year of celebrating all that makes this podcast and this community magical.
I'm so glad that I found your podcast.
I just cannot thank you enough for just being the voice of reason as I'm trying to figure all of this out.
Thank you, and cheers to your incredible show and the vision you had to provide this space for all of us.
This is still a show about life after giving life. And yes, there will be swears. You can find us on MaximumFun.org. And as always, you are doing a great job.
All right, class. Tomorrow's exam will cover the science of cosmic rays, the morals of art forgery, and whether or not fish can drown. Any questions? Yes, you in the back.
What is this?
It's the podcast Let's Learn Everything,
where we learn about science and a bit of everything else. My name's Tom. I study cognitive and computer science, but I'll also be your teacher for intermediate emojis.
My name's Caroline, and I did my master's in biodiversity conservation, and I'll be teaching you intro to things the British Museum stole.
My name's Ella. I did a PhD in stem cell biology, so obviously I'll be teaching you the history of fan fiction.
Class meets every other Thursday on Maximum Fun.
So do I still get credit for this?
No.
Obviously not.
No.
It's a podcast.
Well, there's a new ship. She's got the right name. She's got the right name. Now you remember that, you hear?
So at the diplomatic conference, we learn a little bit about constrained resources in the newly resurgent Federation. They're being asked by this representative from one planet to rebuild their star base, but there's other planets that also need star bases. And
there's also a faction of Nsabimbis in there. No star base in my backyard. Is a feeling they ride for.
Yeah, I mean, they show up at pretty much any political event, you know.
They're just getting in the way of progress.
Yeah, so, yeah, this guy is making an impassioned plea for another star
base.
Do
you think if you're if you don't like a McElroy show, you're Nsabimbam? And if you don't like either, you're Nsabimbam Nsabimbi?
Yeah.
All right.
And if you only specifically don't like McElroy shows that get a little bit blue and also don't want star bases in your backyard, that would be an SFW and some bim bam and some bimby.
That is the worst episode title we've ever had.
Oh yeah, by a lot, by a long shot.
Really excited to see that one in the podcatcher.
How about new?
You know what? We'll probably get 20,000 more downloads because it's got my bam bam in it.
Yeah. They keep talking about President Rillick and cutting to a human woman in this scene where, and I was like, are they Did they like recast and re-species President Rillick?
This is like when I can't tell if my wife got a haircut or not. Like, I just didn't want to even ask if this was the same person.
Saru proposes this thing where he's like, we're going to do this starbase for you guys later, but we'll step up the patrols in the meantime. This is put to a vote. And oh no, Adam, when this ambassador that was making the plea raises his hand to vote, he holds up a spiky bird and it becomes clear that he is from that planet.
Yeah, the planet we haven't talked about since very, very early in TNG. Yeah.
But we're bringing a lot of things back from TNG, good and bad.
When Saru raises his hand to be in favor of this, his finger should count as 1.5 votes, right? And if he really likes it, maybe 1.75.
Mm, yeah. How did a Vulcan get a name like Dugan?
I don't know. Do you think when Saru raises his hand to vote and gets excited about what he's voting for, the rest of the people at the table are like, it's best to just let him finish?
Yeah, you just kind of let him. It goes quicker than you think it will if you just kind of let him go.
This Mr. Dubin guy really wants to talk to Saru after the vote. And what he has to tell him is that, you know, appearances matter in politics. And maybe announcing your engagement is a bad idea because it would damage Trina's political status. So if you think you're having a bad day now, why don't you chew on that for a while? That maybe your relationship is going to be a reason for political failure on her part?
Yeah, like she would get voted out of office by the Vulcan purists or something.
Yeah.
He just wants Saru to slow his roll. Like, think about the delicate political situation we're in and maybe not make the wedding announce right this second.
There's sort of a phantom limb to this conversation, which is like, does Dubin want Trina's job? Is that part of why he's sowing this kind of thing? Is that even possible for a Vulcan to do? I don't know, but when we're talking about political figures and infighting and reputations and stuff, I couldn't help but think that there was another layer to this.
Right, like some palace intrigue where something that goes to, you know, fuck with Tarina's program benefits him.
There is never palace intrigue at a Vulcan palace. That's the thing.
They're raising their eyebrows, but not at anything about what's going on inside the palace.
Right.
They're intrigued by other shit.
Yeah.
So in the rock quarry, Janal takes them, you know, on this hike, and Book and Burnham are hearing scary monster aliens. And he's like, oh yeah, that's why I hid it here. Like, full of dangerous monsters. So perfect place to hide a clue. And he gives them a little kind of history rundown of the project. Like, they found this progenitor tech. It was him and a bunch of scientists that were put together by the Federation. But when they found the technology, it killed one of the scientists in their research group. And because of how dangerous they felt it was, they destroyed all their research and hid the location of the technology because it was the Dominion War. And so, like, somebody learning the location of this all-powerful technology could have really fucked things up.
I've been raw-dogging this season without watching that episode of TNG that they're referring to here.
Yeah.
Is the fact that you've watched that episode recently, is that adding to your enjoyment and understanding of what's happening? In a scene like this specifically that's pointing directly at it.
I would say maybe a little bit. Like, this is not something that is directly addressed in that episode, but it is sort of something you wonder about at the end of it, because they're like, oh, like, we found out about this species that, like, panspermiaed life all over the galaxy, and that's why there are so many humanoids in Star Trek that, you know, all sort of look the same except for a different loaf. And I think they do, like, there's probably like a captain's log at the end where he's like, we'll like have to study this further or something like that. But yeah, like, tying it to the Dominion War, I thought was like a really interesting moment. Like, yeah, like, I mean, when you're dealing with a different existential threat, adding a new secondary existential threat to the pile sounds scary and like a real unknown. So that hung together for me pretty well.
So back on Discovery, it's clear that Rayner has not stopped working on his Mole and Locke project. He's tracked them to Lyric. When Tilly brings in the first contestant of the parade of folks that he will be made to meet, and it's Reese. And the way that these meetings are going to work, there are going to have to be some ground rules here. 20 words or less is what every one of these folks gets, which is roughly double the amount of words Patrick Kwok-Chun usually gets in an episode. So it's a big improvement for him and many of the actors who work on the bridge crew.
Yeah, but it kind of feels like speed dating. Like,
yeah,
Rayner is just there to be like, what do you got? Like, hit me with your best thing that isn't in your file. And so Reese is like, I really dig Constitution class starships. And, you know, Linus has had a clutch of eggs a bunch of times. Unclear whether that was before or after they jumped to the future.
Right. Yeah. Those eggs are long gone now.
Yeah.
We got the folks that we met on the bridge before, absent a couple of them. And at the end of this sequence, it's clear that Rayner may be bad at people, but he is great at meetings. One of my earliest managers used to always say, a great meeting starts on time and ends on time. And that always stuck with me. Rayner is that kind of manager.
Yeah, he's really turning them and burning them.
Mm-hmm.
And Tilly fucking hates this. She does not feel like he is taking the order that he received seriously. She's not really in a position to do anything about it due to her own rank disparity with him. But yeah, she was pretty grossed out by the whole situation.
Speaking of needing exactly 30 seconds to do a fairly serious thing. On Trill, Gray breaks up with Adira. In a way that mature people are able to do.
Yeah.
Gray is like, look, we both see how difficult this has been and how differently we have grown in the absence from each other. Nothing is going to undo the great connection we have. But
how surprised were you in this moment?
By what?
I guess the reason I'm asking it that way is I was like, okay, this is going to be the episode where Adira and Gray break up. The first scene with Adira in it, I was like, okay, that's what's going to happen this episode. They keep talking it up. Okay, now they've talked about it a couple of times before Adira and Gray have had a chance to actually sit down and do the breaking up. So maybe this is going in a different direction. And then as they're having the conversation, Gray's like, well, there's all kinds of relationships. And I was like, oh, fuck, are they going to become poly right now? Like, is this going to be like Disco doing a new kind of representation that we've never seen in Star Trek before? And I got really excited.
Maybe we could try something different.
I don't know if I can do this any other way.
And then they fucking broke up and I was like, what?
The idea that Star Trek would put all of its representation eggs into the Adira and Gray basket is very funny to me.
Yeah. I mean, like, wouldn't it though?
Yeah. Remind me, like, was Gray always the mature one of them both? I think he was.
Yeah. I think Gray, or if not more mature, more self-possessed.
Right. I really admire this thing that he does because, like, and I really am surprised and impressed at how Adira takes this. Because one of the toughest lessons I've ever had to learn in my life was, like, you need to learn when to stop fighting for and trying to sell another person on the idea of being in a relationship with you. Like,
right.
If you have to work that hard to convince another person to love you the way that you desire to be loved, then that's work that you shouldn't have to do, and it's work you'll end up doing for the rest of the time you're in that relationship.
Totally.
And good job by Adira to be like, I get it. Like, all of this makes sense. Let's move on to the next phase of whatever this is.
It really felt like something that they both wanted.
Mm-hmm.
It just was easier for Gray to say out loud first. And, you know, sometimes that's always one person in a relationship.
Yeah.
We cut back to Janal and Michael Burnham and Book.
I've been calling him Janulber.
Janulber, that's good. They're like, hey, Janulber, so clues and riddles, like, give me a fucking break. Can you just tell us where the next thing is or where the technology is? Like, it's obvious that you know where the technology is. Can you save us some steps?
We can actually skip this whole clue trail.
No.
This is sort of where the episode starts to answer the question I think that we both had about what Janal's motivations were when they first did the ritual that brought him out of the lady's consciousness, which is like, it seems like these clues and the idea of this being sort of a wild goose chase was something that this group of scientists designed as a way of like determining the worthiness of whoever ultimately finds the technology. Like, they did not want to bury the technology forever. They wanted it to be found by somebody who could be entrusted with it.
This is such an interesting moment, because when Janulber says these things, Book and Michael Burnham have got to feel like, oh, great, we're the right people. We passed the test. But as they become led further and further into these rocks, and day turns to night, and they start to hear the howling of dangerous sounding creatures, you think maybe they have not passed all the tests.
Yeah, they see some roadkill, but then they get to where the puzzle piece is supposedly hidden, and it's like carved into a rock. She like confirms it by superimposing the image from the Romulan notebook on the rock. I was like, yeah, we know what that thing looks like by now. Like, we've seen it in every episode.
Yeah. Just in case this is where you're beginning Star Trek Discovery.
This is the first episode you've watched. You might want to know this, but this like angry monster comes out of nowhere and it can cloak and shoot darts at them.
This is why I would not be welcome in this writer's room, because once the idea of cloaked monster is presented, I'd be like, oh yeah, and Book like accidentally steps in cloaked poop and he's like, why do I stink so bad? Oh,
Michael.
I don't see anything in the treads in my boot. Like they're clean. I swear. Adam, why don't you go grab us coffee while we finish breaking this one?
This monster has them pinned down, and like Burnham tries to work the puzzle while Book distracts them, but another monster shows up and Book like knocks Michael out of the way, but catches a stray in saving her.
This thing is like a fucking lawn dart.
Yeah.
It is huge. I thought for sure, this being new Star Trek, we'd get an ECU of like what is like a bee stinger, like throbbing and putting poison in. Like,
yeah.
The way that would work.
It does seem like it could deliver like a solid liter of neurotoxin or something. This thing is huge.
A totally disturbing amount. Yeah.
Yeah. So now that Book is probably going to die, we cut up to Rayner's rolling meetings where Stamets comes in geeking out about the tricorder data, because they have like the tricorder from that derelict Romulan ship. And he's been going through it. And something that Jet Reno said about everything having a half-life helped him solve all this math that he's been looking at. I guess like it made him understand something about the technology and how like potentially you could use it to bring someone back from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
So he's really geeking out. And Rayner's like, cool, gotcha. Get the hell out.
Nice to meet you too, Commander.
Okay, what?
This is when Tilly finally loses it on him, and she really reads him. She's like, you're like ashamed to be here having been demoted, and so you're being a dick to everyone, and it's like super disrespectful and bad, and we don't like you.
Here's what I want to say about this. I'm glad Tilly felt the energy to call Rayner out on his shit, but also, why does everyone have to be nice on this ship? And I'm not saying that Rayner isn't nice. I think there's not anything about Rayner that's been mean in these scenes. He's just direct. He's direct and specific.
Yeah.
And there's one person in my life that this kind of reminds me of, and I hope this doesn't come back to bite me later when Rainer turns out to be a total monster. But like, all my interactions with John Hodgman have been a little bit like this. He's so precise and specific with the things he talks about and the way he puts things that, like, I am delighted by him. And I love all of our interactions. But, like, I don't read that as mean.
Yeah.
I can understand how some people would. But, like, this show is so largely about the acceptance of people's differences. But why is the burden always put on the people who are not overly sensitive on this ship? Like, there are all kinds of people on the across the entire spectrum of neuroses. And I just think it's unfair that, I mean, until the reveal is that Rainer's a shitty person and a monster and a murderer or whatever, and is in with Mullen Locke, like, that remains to be seen. But like,
yeah,
everyone loading up on him for just wanting to be protective of his time and being a certain kind of way that is definitely not mean is unfair to me at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that...
Speaking for the sensitive, Benjamin R. Harrison.
No, I almost wonder if where Tilly is coming from is more of a rule follower who really, like, cares about... I mean, like, so much of her arc has been about heading toward command as fast as she possibly could from what many, including her, would probably describe as, like, a personality deficit relative to the kind of personality of most commanders.
Mm-hmm.
And then realizing that that wasn't going to be her path and changing it up very recently makes somebody like who has all the command personality he wants and is not using it to do the thing he's been asked to do is just like extremely grating for her personally.
That is such a great read. But is that in this scene and in their interactions?
Know.
I wish that was a little bit less buried, if that's a part of this relationship they have.
I'll be curious to see if that's the way they take it, because it could just be that they're laying track for that.
Mm-hmm.
But also it could be that they're laying track for Rainer ultimately being a villain or ultimately being like a total self-sacrificing hero. Like, we could still go a lot of ways with this character.
Yeah, I think either of those tracks would be fairly obvious. I hope it's something else.
So Saru goes to Trina and pitches a postponement on their save the dates. She spots that this was Dugan, like, immediately. She's like, this is that fucking Dugan guy. Probably put pressure on you.
When you propose a postponement, you're talking about a pro-post... pro-postponement?
He's Pop Anonymous?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when that's asking somebody to prom, that would be a promposal-ponement.
And when you do that while also giving a gift of a grapefruit LaCroix, it's a pro-post-prom-pomple-moose-onement.
I do think that that's what that's called. So Saru has proposed this triple flip check.
Double check, triple check, check, triple double check.
And she knows where this came from, and she is very pissed that Saru is being overprotective and, like, in the most Vulcan way possible, storms out.
Excuse me. I must go.
Oh. The greatest trek is yet to come.
We're back in the canyon where Michael Burnham and Book realize that these giant, terrifying, dart-shooting, cloaking monsters are just defending their eggs. They're doing what all parents do.
Told you I wasn't going to do this. I'm putting you back on the spot.
Okay.
Did you think Book was going to die this episode at this moment?
I think that when you cut back and he doesn't have, like, dark tendrils coming up his neck, you're not worried, you know?
Do you think Book is going to die this season?
Ooh. Boy. Yeah, maybe.
You know why I don't think he will? Well, maybe this is a reason that he actually will. There's not a moment in this scene where Book approaches death in a way that's observable. Like, there's no moment where Michael's cradling his head in her lap, like, with tears rolling down her cheeks. Like, this might be it. You know? Yeah. Like, the scene's too action-packed.
Yeah, and this show is not afraid to have a tears rolling down Michael Burnham's cheeks, this might be it moment.
So maybe they're saving that for later, like, toward the end.
But they realize that since the critters are just defending their nest, maybe the running in with guns approach was the wrong thing to do. So they put the guns down and go out, and Book is able to use his telepathic ability to reason with the critters, and this enables them to walk safely back to where Janal has been, just like chilling the most, looking at stars, lying out on his back.
Just cranking out a bunch of Shups.
Yeah. Really impressed with the way this guy takes care of his birdie.
If you could snap your fingers and all of a sudden your body was like totally ripped and exploded like Wilson Cruz's body was, like, I would absolutely go to the gym.
Yeah.
Like, it would feel so good to, like, put up weight.
I've missed this.
That's it. Get it.
Yeah. Be really nice. He has had the clue piece right there the whole time.
Where were you keeping that, Janober?
Yeah. How did you know who to put it in?
So is that the thing that made room for... the other thing to go in later?
But yeah, like, making peace with the monsters was the test. It's like, we had to make sure that the person to get the clue piece wasn't a go in and kill everybody that's standing in your way kind of person. And so they've got coordinates for the third clue now that they have the second piece. So Ryu apologizes to Trina. She's super cool about this whole thing, and they have a conversation about how conflict is not to be feared. What?
Trina's kind of the gray of this relationship, huh?
Yeah, no kidding.
She's a good arguer. This lady relationships.
She can get it.
Mm-hmm. At the end of this scene, Trina does something to Saru's chin that I really want Captain Pike to do with Captain Patel's dimple. Which is just like, insert a finger.
Yeah. Like, wow, you can really fit your whole thumb in there, can't you, Pike?
Just pulls her cheek on like a pair of pants.
Yeah. Wow. Have you been spreading out? Did you have a relic in there to kind of get it ready?
You're, of course, talking about a dimple plug.
A dimple plug, yeah. Flared base. They tell Guardian Z, like, hey, so these, like, murdering assholes might come around looking for this. And he's like, nah, we got those guys. Don't worry about it.
You remember we had those poles with spikes at the end?
Yeah.
I got that.
The old lady says, thanks for coming so I can now finally die. This is great. Back on Discovery, Tilly knocks back a Sluggo Cola.
Drink Sluggo Cola.
The slime is cola in the galaxy.
Holy mackerel, that is a business with some longevity.
Sure is. Good for them.
They've been around longer than Zildjian symbols at this point.
Every once in a while you remind me of what giant nerds we've become. And maybe you always were.
Yeah, yeah. Another conversation with Rayner here about, like, respecting the crew and, you know, like, knowing trivia about them is not the same thing as making them feel like the person second most responsible for their safety actually gives a shit about them.
This is another instance of how the show, I think, by flipping the order of things, could show instead of tell, because the insistence on telling people what their behavior should be instead of modeling them so that they can think about themselves or their place in the world differently is sort of like how I wanted this scene to play out. Like, you're not giving Rayner a chance to grow by Tilly telling him how he's got to live. Instead, we get Tilly telling him that, and then we get the vignettes of all the crew people and their Miriam relationships.
Yeah.
You know, they're living a life that Rayner could have.
right.
if he decided to treat people differently.
How did you feel about this scene with Culber and the captain? Because they're kind of talking about like, oh, I want everything in life to have an answer. Like he's talking about his abuela having like a collection of different religious iconography because...
I thought it was weirdly hostile. Like the subtext is hostile because Culber's describing an abuela that lived kind of a beautiful and open life where she was comforted by the idea of like unanswered questions. And Michael's like, oh yeah, I would smash those fucking crosses. And
and Culber agrees. Like he's like, yeah, fuck that. I've never really thought of that. Like, I don't think of them as having cross purposes, but they really seem to be establishing something about...
Well, the abuela had cross purposes, as well all the other altars and things that she had there.
But the scene seems to be really, like, trying to specifically establish something about Michael Burnham and Culber being on a similar journey.
Right, yeah.
Which kind of surprised me. We get Gray eulogizing... Bix, and I guess the lady that Bix was in also. We don't see her body, but we see Bix swim away in the milk pool, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the Trill Koi Pond has another participant.
Yeah. Every life is a journey. That's the reminder here.
They grab Bix and then like slowly release the Trill into the water, and the beginning guitar strains to Life is a Highway plays. And that's the end of the episode. How fucking great would that be?
That would have ruled. Adira says their goodbye and is like walking around like doing the good game, good game, good game to all the other Trills there. And we see a little, I don't know, some kind of device.
Mm-hmm.
And then a reveal that Maul has been there the whole time. In the cloak of a local Trill Cave person.
Ben, am I remembering this right? Didn't Tilly have a little sparkly thing land on and go inside her a season or so ago? And then nothing ever happened with that?
Yeah.
What's up with things being stuck on people and disappearing? My point being, everything's probably fine here and this thing isn't going to do anything.
Probably won't come up again.
Did you like this episode, Ben?
She'll always bring it home.
I did like this episode. I feel like we've been maybe meaner sounding than I intended to be. I thought that this was a nice little adventure. Generally speaking, I thought that the character development stuff was interesting. Like, it's so interesting to see Saru especially like go through relationship stuff because he's such a relationships neophyte, but he's also so emotionally even keeled and in touch with his own wants and desires that he can just say out loud what he needs without like losing his mind, you know?
It's what makes a Vulcan companion, I think, so perfect for him.
Yeah, and I keep thinking it's kind of remarkable that works so well in this show. Like, I never really thought of Kelpians as being really Vulcan-y, but they are very compatible with Vulcans in the way they've been written. And I think that that's really nicely observed. And I'm loving Discovery just being like, yeah, we're going to be super Discovery about this. It's going to be a bunch of clues. We're finding clues and like solving a mystery that somebody set up as a mystery. Like, that is really appealing to me this season.
I don't think I was mean to this episode. I think I was critical in some parts. I'll say that. I like the arc. This adventure arc is fun to me. But I think some holes got poked in the idea of it this episode when we got to spend some time with Janulber. Because there's that moment... And we didn't talk too much about this during the episode because we were going on too many tangents. But when Janulber kind of does that final check with Michael and Book about like, you know, we just want to make sure the right people have it and it's not a time of war or whatever. And Michael's like, you know, humanoids contain multitudes and most of us are good. And that's just as good as it's going to get. And that's the most I can promise. And also, we're not at war now, but we could be down the road. No promises. That seems like a case that's fairly convincing against a person like Janolber giving over another clue and allowing mm-hmm. this to happen.
Right.
Why does this thing ever need to be found? Is kind of where I'm at with this adventure. Like, I know we need the adventure because we're trying to make a TV show here, but like, everything about this is too dangerous, and nothing yeah. about Michael Burnham and Book, even though they were very cool to a cloaked monster who makes cloaked shits, like, no one is trustworthy enough to have this power. I guess the point is to beat Mullen Locke
yeah.
to the end. It's a race. It's a race show.
It's a we can't let it fall into the wrong hands argument more than it is a we deserve to have this more than anyone argument.
But Janolber doesn't really know about that.
Yeah. Unless Janolber knows everything that Janol knows and everything that Culber knows or something.
Yeah.
I don't remember how the ritual works. Like, I feel like they explain this type of ritual in much more vivid detail in a show like Deep Space Nine. And in Discovery, it's always just like, okay, we're fucking doing it, you know?
I kind of wonder if this is all leading to a moment that was like Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade. Like that pick the cup moment. Like, if Mullen yeah. Locke and Michael Burnham and Book are going to be like standing in a row trying to prove their worthiness of the thing in the very end, if that isn't going to be what gives it up for the right person.
Right.
You have chosen wisely.
I just wish Janolber was a little more like Mr. Wing and Gremlins, is my point. Like a little more defensive of the powerful thing.
Yeah. That would be nice. I mean, that'd be fun.
Yeah. Yeah, more Mr. Wing in more places.
Do you want to go see if Mr. Wing is in the Priority One inbox?
Hey, there he is.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
He's just down a very dark stairwell into our first Priority One message, Ben. This is from Chris in DC. It's to Adam and Ben. Their message goes like this. I took my then fiance to your first live show in DC and was never allowed to go to another one to support my favorite podcast.
Oh no!
That was at the Black Cat, right? Was it?
Yeah. First live show in DC was with the Black Cat.
That was the first live show that Wendy saw, as I recall.
Yeah, wow.
My then fiance is now my ex-wife. And now I hear you guys are not going to do a tour this year. I need Ben to do one of his rants to express how disappointed I am.
God damn it! To go through the whole thing of being married to somebody that doesn't let me do my nerdy shit, and now, finally, I'm out from under? And I can't even go to do my nerdy shit because the nerds aren't even coming to DC this year!
P.S. I requested you guys review Airplane 2. You're welcome. Hey, if that was the reason, thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
Find yourself your Trina. Maybe that's what's next for you. I hope it is.
Yeah. Our next P1 is from Guy English. Hey, Guy. How you doing? It's to Ben and Adam, and it goes like this. I up my membership, and to all FODs who can, up yours. Ben and Adam, never take the advice of viewers like me. You've been killing it with the pilot season, Santa Monica Mountains, and Factory Seconds. The bonus feed is the good shit. Guinan keeps on the top shelf for Scotty. Don't change a thing. That said, how do I bankroll Greatest Galactica? Wow.
If your bankroll was made of time, that would be a start.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm happily reminded by Guy English about the good year / good couple of years we've had in the bonus feed. Really fun times we're having in there.
Yeah. I would be surprised if some Galactica content did not show up in your bonus feed sooner or later.
I'm with you there. Well, Priority One messages are one of the many ways you can support our programs. You can put your words into our mouths by going to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron.
Please do.
Hey, Ben.
Oh, what's that, Adam?
Did you find yourself an Edward Larkin?
Edward Larkin! Whew. I think I'm going to give it to Jet Reno this time.
It's almost a cameo, right?
Yeah, and like to be there giving the, you know, older sibling kind of advice about love, to like to see what is happening for what it is, and to be, seemingly be the only one that's like aware of it in Adira's life.
Yeah.
Was a fun role for Jet Reno. I kept wondering about like what's going on with Stamets and Culber in this episode. Like, no phone call back home when Culber's like about to get an alien Katra inserted into his mind, like a potentially shattering experience that he'll have to do a lot of work to reassemble the pieces after.
And afterward, not seeking him out to give the download to. Instead, yeah, that happens with Michael Burnham. Yeah, I wonder.
And like, you know, Stamets like totally not clued into this, you know, relationship crisis that Adira has been headed for, you know, since Adira had a speaking line in season 5.
Yeah.
Like, sort of wondering about that. But yeah, who'd your Edward Larkin wind up being?
Boy, I had one and then we talked about it just then, and now I think it's going to be Stamets. Just
okay.
Just how occasionally oblivious he was this episode. And I mean, there's something admirable about how hands off he is as a parent, you know, not being a helicopter dad.
Yeah.
I also love that he flipped shit right back at Rayner directly. Like, he did not ask for permission to speak freely. He was a little cutting at the end of his meeting. And I like that.
Good stuff.
So make mine Stamets.
Well, we just have one last segment here on the show, Adam, and it is the Warning Bois segment. Do you want to hit the folks with a Warning Bois?
Hitting it.
Prepare a buoy and launch it when ready.
Warning buoys.
An emergency buoy. A warning buoy.
Ben, here's a 5-star review off of Apple Podcasts.
Okay.
Headlined, funniest sci-fi podcast out there.
Wow.
Goes like this. From the jump, I've loved Ben and Adam's take on New Trek. Equal parts hilarious and heartfelt, and was thrilled when they turned their attention to Stargate SG-1 and the new pilot season run. With all the built-in references to Trek in SG-1, I'm hoping it becomes a regular off-season show for them to dig into. Just imagine their reaction to Wormhole Extreme. That one's from Ruby Vroom on Apple Podcasts. Nice 5-star job right there.
Fun.
Those reviews really help us a lot. You know how important the algorithm is. The algorithm rules everything around me. Areem,
get the money.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Five star bills, y'all.
Yeah. Please consider leaving a nice review or just post it on social media about what you like about the show, and your words might fly out of our mouths here on the Warning Bois segment. Okay, that does it for this week's episode. We're going to leave this one in Wendy's capable hands. Take it away, Wendy.
Thanks, Wendy.
Greatest Trek is an Uxbridge Shimoda podcast on the Maximum Fun Network. It's hosted by Ben Harrison and Adam Pranica, and it's produced and edited by Wendy Pretty. Next Friday, Ben and Adam will be back to cover Star Trek Discovery Season 5, Episode 4, called Face the Strange. And if you have a moment to leave a 5-star rating or review for the show, we really appreciate you doing that. Another thing that helps people find us is your word-of-mouth recommendations. Membership support is what keeps the podcast going, so we want to say thanks to everyone who supports on a monthly basis. There's a huge collection of bonus content available to members, and we're putting out new bonus episodes every single month, so it's a great value, and we really appreciate your support at MaximumFun.org/join. Thanks to Adam Ragusea, who composed the theme music for Greatest Trek. Find him on YouTube, and while you're there, make sure you're subscribed to the Greatest Trek YouTube channel as well. Thanks to Nick Ditmore for creating the show art, and thanks to Bill Tilley and Rob Adler for all their work managing the various social media pages. You can find those by searching for @GreatestTrek and use the hashtag GreatestTrek when you post about the show. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on Greatest Trek.
Maximum Fun,
a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows
supported
directly
by you.